Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Axis Mundi.
Welcome to One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew L. Seidel, a constitutional attorney and the author of The Founding Myth and American Crusade. This is a podcast about religion, the law, and the battle for America's soul. We'll be separating church and state, defending freedom and equality, and fighting Christian nationalism. If you haven't already, sign up for our weekly bonus content and ad-free listening at accessmundi.us. LFG, folks. In all his time on the bench, Chief Justice John Roberts has read one dissent, just one, aloud. For most of the Supreme Court's history, when the justices would announce an opinion, they'd also read the opinion, or at least summarize it. And this was a long process, time-consuming. If you have read law, you know it can be stale or sterile. Read aloud, it can be soporific. So in 1969, Chief Justice Warren Burger had enough. Burger began discouraging justices from this tedious practice, saving, by his estimate, some 300 hours a year and untold misery. Burger did make an exception in U.S. versus Nixon, reading a 17-minute summary of the unanimous 8-0 opinion that held Nixon must turn over his tapes and other evidence to that special prosecutor, and that neither confidentiality nor the separation of powers could prevent that. Put another way, the court unanimously held that the president is not above the law, and that includes in criminal inquiries. Would that the court were so clear today. Nixon would resign 2 weeks later. So since 1969, the new tradition has been that the justices will occasionally read important summaries, important opinions, or excerpts, or dissents when they are first announced. What's important? Well, whatever the justices think. It's their call. It's what they think is important. And in his 20 years on the bench, there has only been one case in which John Roberts was so moved that he read his dissent aloud. He began.
From the dawn of human history until a few years ago, for every people known to have populated this planet, marriage was defined as the union of a man and a woman. That is true for the Kalahari Bushmen and the Han Chinese, for the Carthaginians and the Aztecs, for any civilization at any time, at any place in the world, and certainly for those who wrote and ratified our Constitution. But today, 5 lawyers have ordered every state to change its definition of marriage to one that matches a new one that they favor, because those lawyers have, in their words, new insight and a better informed understanding of liberty. Just who do we think we are?
The case was Obergefell v. Hodges, that 2015 case in which the Supreme Court, 5-4, finally, at long last, held that we have a fundamental right to marry, and that right includes same-sex spouses. Or as Justice Kennedy, who was the swing vote at the time, wrote in his majority opinion, "In forming a marital union, two people become something greater than once they were. As some of the petitioners in this case demonstrate, marriage embodies a love that may endure even past death. It would misunderstand these men and women to say they disrespect the idea of marriage. Their plea is that they do respect it so deeply that they seek to find its fulfillment for themselves. Their hope is not to be condemned to live in loneliness, excluded from one of civilization's oldest institutions. They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right." Obergefell gave us marriage equality. And Scalia and Thomas and Alito and Roberts dissented. They were so incensed that they each wrote their own dissenting opinions. "Just who do we think we are?" asks John Roberts in his dissent. "Just who do we think we are in a case extending equal rights to loving, consenting couples? Just who do we think we are in a case realizing equality? Just who do we think we are in a case bringing us ever closer to the aspirational values of equality and freedom, and that we the people means everyone? Just who do we think we are in a case where at long last love won? Just who do we think we are?" Lately, I've had several friends and colleagues ask me a different question. Could the conservative justices on this Supreme Court overturn marriage equality? Could they? Would they? Will they? That's the question that we are going to answer today. Is this court a threat to marriage equality? Is there a chance we lose it? Is it really at risk? Helping me answer that question is a friend, author, and expert in this area, Brandon Wolf. You are going to want to hear what he has to say. I do not want to panic anyone. The goal today is not to worry people or make them afraid, but to explain the legal landscape with realism. And we're going to hear from Brandon, and I can tell you from our text and email exchanges setting this interview up that you're going to want to stay for that conversation. Before I bring him on to ask some of the hard questions, I want to set the table for this discussion for you. I first wrote about the possibility of the Supreme Court reversing marriage equality for Religion Dispatches back in 2021. I began, "When I look at this broken, packed, partisan Supreme Court, I don't see a guardian. I see a threat to our basic human rights. I see an institution packed with ideologues eager to throw out decades of settled law." That's still what I see. And if we count heads, if we count votes, if we do a SCOTUS whip count, I get worried. We already talked about Roberts. That's one vote. In 2018, I spoke publicly about the dangers of Kavanaugh replacing Kennedy on the court and what it might mean in this area in particular, because Justice Kennedy was the fifth vote for Obergefell in that 5-4 decision. So if you replace that swing vote with a vote that swings the other way, like Kavanaugh, you get a different outcome in that case. And during his confirmation hearing, Kavanaugh refused many times to answer questions about Obergefell as precedent.
You're the nominee right now, and so it is probative of your ability to serve on the highest court in our land. So I'm asking you a very specific question. Either you're willing to answer or not, and if you're not willing to answer it, we can move on. But do you believe Obergefell was correctly decided?
So each of the justices have declined, as a matter of judicial independence, each of them, to answer questions in that line of cases.
So you will not answer that question?
Following the precedent set by those eight justices, they've all declined.
Thank you.
When
Thank
asked
you,
to answer that question.
That is an alarming dodge. And he gave a much stronger answer for Roe versus Wade when asked.
Senator, I said that it's settled as a precedent of the Supreme Court entitled to respect under principles of stare decisis. And one of the important things to keep in mind about Roe v. Wade is that it has been reaffirmed many times over the past 45 years.
And yet, Kavanaugh overturned that settled precedent entitled to respect, reaffirmed many times over 45 years. So that's two. Barrett was just as obstructionist as Kavanaugh in her confirmation hearing, but she comes from a scarier religious background. Just as one, for instance, we could do a deep dive on her later, she signed on to a letter in 2015, the same year Obergefell was decided. A letter to synod fathers from Catholic women. This is basically a letter to Catholic bishops. And that letter proclaimed that marriage and family founded on the indissoluble commitment of a man and a woman. That's what it was committed to. That's what these women were committed to. So that is three. Alito dissented in Obergefell. So did Clarence Thomas. And when it became clear that the Senate was going to confirm Barrett in 2020, despite a presidential election in which millions of people had already voted, and with Election Day looming just days away, Thomas wrote an opinion that Alito joined. They argued in that opinion, again, when it was clear that Barrett was going to get on the court, that religious freedom should trump marriage equality. That is insane, and I direct you to American Crusade for more. But here's a taste of that short opinion. Quote, Davis may have been one of the first victims of this court's cavalier treatment of religion in its Obergefell decision. She will not be the last. And, quote, by choosing to privilege a novel constitutional right over the religious liberty interests explicitly protected in the First Amendment and doing so undemocratically, the court has created a problem that only it can fix. Until then, Obergefell will continue to have, quote, ruinous consequences for religious liberty. That's four and five. Five votes is enough, so we don't even need to look at Gorsuch, but he has written similar things about LGBTQ equality conflicting with religious freedom, even in the Bostock case, which was a win for LGBTQ equality and an opinion that Gorsuch authored. So that is the ultra-conservative block of the court, the captured block of the court, the packed court, and where they might stand. But their views in the abstract don't necessarily matter, right? Well, at least not in the before times, maybe, right? Maybe there was a time when the Christian nationalist wing of this country didn't own the court and seek to impose political change through the court that it had captured. But they do now. That's how they overturned Roe versus Wade. And so the conservative and Christian nationalist legal groups tee up cases for the captured court to deliver on GOP promises, to check every box on the GOP wish list. So there are groups like Liberty Counsel, which used to be on the extreme fringe of the conservative legal movement. But that movement has become so virulent that Liberty Counsel is effectively now mainstream on that side of things, at least mainstream since the pandemic, well, again, on that side of things. And Liberty Counsel is the group that is behind Kim Davis. The Kim Davis case, the ongoing saga, talked about it extensively in American Crusade. Liberty Counsel espouses the Christian supremacy goals more openly than many of the other Christian nationalist legal groups out there. It claims to be a Christian ministry, quote, ministry, that's the word it uses, with a, quote, Christian mission. It also claims to fight for religious freedom, by which it means Christian supremacy, because what it actually does is, quote, advances religious freedom by advocating, supporting, advancing, and defending the good news about Jesus Christ.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to five pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Matt and Anita Staver run the outfit, which is designated a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Here is what Matt Staver recently said.
I think we're at a ripe time to overrule Obergefell and bring it back to the states like it was before. There is no so-called constitutional right in the Constitution to same-sex marriage. That's ridiculous. And it's as ridiculous as to think that there's a right to kill your child in the Constitution. There's not, never has been. And so I think it's just a matter of when, not if, Obergefell will be overturned. It's not an if, it's just a matter of when. And this case of Kim Davis could be the one that overturns Obergefell.
It's if, not when, says the zealot. And yes, that Kim Davis case That's what he's talking about there, if you can believe it. It is still ongoing. In fact, just a couple days ago, the Sixth Circuit, a three-judge panel, decided against Kim Davis again. Now Liberty Counsel is asking the entire Sixth Circuit, that's called an en banc review, if and when they lose there before the entire Sixth Circuit, Liberty Counsel can and will ask the Supreme Court to take the case again. And even though this is ongoing and it may be convenient, I do not think the Supreme Court is likely to use the Kim Davis case as a vehicle to overturn Obergefell. If the court wants to do it, if these justices do want to do it, this is a complicated, convoluted case to do so. It's been going on for so long, and it's bounced up and down so much that it gets ugly. It's not clean. Now, cutting against that fact is that this case began right after Obergefell, which might make it seem later on in the eyes of history that they're overturning less precedent because it was so quickly started after the 2015 decision. In other words, the precedent's not longstanding if they decide this case. And it, of course, it has the religious element, which we know these justices have a hard time resisting. Even with all that, I don't think they're going to want such a convoluted case, such a complicated case. They'll want something new, something clean. So we're probably a few years out from anything getting to the Supreme Court, a clean vehicle, which is what the justices are going to want. Now, it's not just the legal groups. It's also Christian nationalist legislators in many states. They are proposing, as they did with Roe, blatantly unconstitutional laws, hoping for a legal challenge that will work its way up to John, just who do we think we are, Roberts. But these aren't so much laws as they are resolutions. It's just a bunch of legislators getting together and say, we want this thing, not necessarily actually a law. So that is an important distinction, and I bet Brandon and I will talk about that. But I do want to address a couple of these because they're blatant and they're obvious. In Michigan, State Representative Josh Scrivener introduced a resolution to overturn marriage equality, and here is how he pitched it.
To my fellow conservatives, if we cannot conserve the bedrock of our civilization, the family, then we can't call ourselves conservatives anymore. Now is the time to do the right thing. Now is the time to reassert the sovereignty of Christ as our King. Now is the time to restore the authority of God and submit our will to He who knows what's best. We must restore the order of the family. The family is the smallest, most intimate governing body in our great nation. May our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ bless you and keep you. May He make His face shine upon you. May He be gracious to you. May He turn His face towards you and give you peace. Amen.
Do the right thing by abusing our power to impose our personal religious beliefs on everyone and rob couples of their rights. That's what he is saying there. That's the translation. Now, a similar resolution was introduced in Idaho by Representative Heather Scott. Why?
I mean, let's face it. It's pretty clear in the Bible, marriage. God designed it is between a man and a woman, correct? I mean, if you read the Bible, if you're religious in any way, you would see that if you read the Bible. So for the government to come and say, no, we've redefined it from God. This country, and I'm not a historian, I'm not a scholar of the Constitution, but this is a Judeo-Christian-based country.
Sure. Yeah.
And our Constitution was designed, it says, for a moral people.
Sure.
And so that morality was built on God's word. Whether people like it or believe in God's word, the founders, that's where our country was built on.
I mean, folks, if there were a God, and if that God were just, she would have me debating Representative Scott. I mean, I listened to quite a bit of that podcast interview for you, dear listener. The things I do for you, dear listener. There is worse in there. There is more frustrating. She clearly doesn't understand her own legislative processes. It's embarrassing. Now, there are also other resolutions in Montana and Oklahoma and South Dakota and Tennessee and Texas, and perhaps more by the time you're hearing this. And I could probably do this for each of those resolutions, find these legislators who are proposing it, citing the Bible and the false narrative, the disinformation about a Judeo-Christian founding. I could probably read through the whereases at the top of each of these resolutions and tear them all apart, which I was contemplating doing for Michigan, because they are so very wrong. But instead of more ranting from me, I want to bring on an expert, a friend, and a man I admire the hell out of, Brandon Wolfe. Brandon Wolfe is a nationally recognized civil rights and gun safety advocate and a seasoned communications expert. He currently serves as National Press Secretary for the Human Rights Campaign, the nation's largest LGBTQ plus civil rights organization. He authored A Place for Us, which is an unforgettable coming-of-age memoir that tells of his life and surviving the Pulse nightclub shooting, and we have overlapped at several events, so I have heard him tell that story a few times, and every time, it brings me to tears. Brandon, my friend, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's dive right in. And you are part of the expert team at Human Rights Campaign. You've got a bunch of brilliant lawyers on staff. You know, what is the level of worry for you and that expert legal team? This is what y'all do. How concerned are you?
Yeah, well, you know, I want to start by acknowledging that people are very worried across this country mm-hmm. about, you know, marriage equality, about their rights and freedoms more broadly. And people are right to be worried about the right wing agenda in this country. And the truth is that the right wing has always been very clear about what their aims are. They've been very clear that they're coming not just for trans people, you know, not just for our ability to decide how and when to start a family. They're coming for all of it. They're mm-hmm. coming for all of the rights and freedoms that we have. And they're the same people who've been architects of you know, the peeling back of freedoms that we've already seen across the country, right? It's the same people who helped to overturn Roe. They're the same people who are tearing at freedom for trans people across the country. Those very same people have been honest that they would love to upend marriage equality. We're talking about organizations like the Alliance Defending Freedom, the Heritage Foundation. Obviously, those are groups that helped to craft Project 2025. And mm-hmm. now it is their agenda that's guiding the policies that are coming out of the Trump administration. So it is important to say that the people are very rightly worried that a group of organizations that Christian nationalist right-wing extremists who are driven by a belief that there's only one right way to be a human being, that there's one right way to dress, to live, to love, to build a family, that those are the people who are driving policy in this country right now. And that those folks, you know, have been clear that if you live outside the bounds of who they think you should be, they want to be able to use government to strip you of your rights and freedoms. With all of that said, I think it makes it more important that we do not give those extremists more power than they actually have. So while they have said very openly that marriage equality is something they are deeply uncomfortable with, and they have been hard at work in the laboratory trying to figure out ways to peel away rights and freedoms up to and including, you know, marriage equality, I think we're a long way from that reality, to be quite frank. And it's important for people to be able to separate fact from fiction here. You know, resolutions in state legislatures, campaign bluster from right-wing politicians, those are not vehicles to strip you of your right to marry the person you love. The right to marriage equality in this country is settled law. It is not an open question. We've also worked really hard to pass federal legislation that adds layers of protection here. So I want folks to know at home, there is no new case or fresh state bill that is moving that is a vehicle that would allow the Supreme Court to revisit their Obergefell ruling. That is not the state of play right now. And so it is important for us to know what our rights are, to sort of know where we are in this political landscape, so that we're not inadvertently complying in advance with this angry, you know, group of extremists, or handing them more power than they actually have. So again, I think two things can be true. One, people are rightly worried. People are worried about the threats that we've heard coming from the right wing. And it is true that we have rock solid legal protections today for our marriages. And we're going to fight, you know, tooth and nail to hold on to those.
I mean, I think that's such a good point, that a lot of the rhetoric that we're seeing right now is just that. It is rhetoric that is not a legal vehicle to get a decision or any kind of case before the Supreme Court. And you know, especially some of those really out there resolutions that we're seeing. You know, you mentioned kind of the fact that people are living outside of this godly binary that they are working, these groups like ADF are working to impose on the country. One of the questions that I always like to answer in this podcast is why? So like, that's one possible reason, but why do you think these extremists and these legislatures, you know, in Idaho, Michigan, Montana, Oklahoma, et cetera, why are they around the country? Are they pushing for this right now? Like, what's the why, do you think?
Well, I think there are two different groups of people with different motivations in this equation. On the one hand, you know, we've talked about the right-wing organizations like ADF and the Heritage Foundation, you know, the American Principles Project, other organizations. Those are the diehard believers that everyone should be forced. The zealots. And they're the ones who believe that everyone should be forced to conform to their idea of who we are supposed to be, right? They are the ones who firmly believe that government should be a tool, should be a weapon against people who don't live a particular way, right? They're the ones who believe that the world is rainbows and unicorns when boys wear blue and girls wear pink and boys drive trucks and girls like Barbies, right? And no one lives outside of those confines. So there are the zealots, the hardcore believers at, you know, organizations like ADF and others. And for a very long time, they have used state legislatures as the laboratories for this agenda. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've seen things like states going from, you know, passing bans on trans kids in sports to, you know, a few years later, they're banning access to healthcare, banning books, censoring curriculum. They're, you know, even suggesting that we need legislation that punishes people for being out as transgender in general. That is the design of these right-wing organizations, these zealots. They test the waters in these state legislatures, and they try to seed the national consciousness with further and further right-wing ideas to try to shift the Overton window, to erode support for freedoms and civil rights more broadly. And they use a scapegoat in order to do that, right? They say, you know, ooh, there are these scary trans people out there. And if you don't hand us all of the power you can find, then they're going to come after you. So you've got to turn over the reins of your freedoms to us, because we will protect you from these scary trans people. And once they get a hold of that power, then they come back for more, right?
Yes.
I like to say that if you give them an inch, they will mandate a mile. That is what they do in these state legislatures, and they test just how far those things can go. So you've got that group of people who have designed these attacks and are the architects of some of the resolutions you're seeing in the state legislatures. And then you've got the state lawmakers, many of whom are not really the zealots. Like, they don't particularly care what happens at the end of the day with marriage equality or with our abilities to build families or, you know, with whether or not a kid can play soccer with their friends. These state lawmakers have allowed themselves to be vessels for the agenda because they've been promised a reward at the end. They've been told they can advance their careers, they're going to be famous, they'll get a podcast deal, whatever it is they're looking for. They've been told that this is the thing that will win them acclaim with the far right base and help set them up for their career aspirations. And so those two groups get into bed together, and the right wing organizations promise all the riches in the world if you simply go along with, you know, this agenda that continues to chisel away at people's rights and freedoms. And I think that's why you're seeing this natural progression in state legislatures right now, to test the waters on some of these other rights and freedoms that the right wing would love to chisel away at.
Yeah, when I was preparing for this episode, I watched Representative Heather Scott from Idaho on a podcast talking about why she proposed this. And I was just struck by how nonsensical and how little she understood even her own legislature's processes. You know, she's talking about how we're a Judeo-Christian country and we're founded on the Bible. That's how she's supporting this resolution, but really doesn't understand, like, even the most basics of civics, which kind of goes along with her resolution. Do you think there is, and I think I heard you say this, but I want to drill down on it explicitly, is this a way to motivate the same political base that might otherwise be kind of growing apart or falling apart after the end of Roe versus Wade? Is that, like, I heard you saying we need to, that basically they need a new thing. And in this case, we're talking about, you know, demonizing people, right? Like otherizing people, a new thing to fight against. Is there an element of that in this, do you think?
There's definitely an element of that. And you don't even have to really believe me. You can ask the architects of this agenda. You can ask the right wing, because they've been very upfront about that. There was a New York Times article, I think, that came out midway through last year, and they were talking about this obsession with transgender young people that's taken hold of the right wing. And they were asking, you know, where did it come from? Where is it headed? Where did the hysteria around trans people birth from? And, you know, I think it was maybe Terry Schilling or somebody at the American Principle Project who said quite openly, you know, after we lost on Obergefell, after we lost on marriage equality, we went back to the drawing board, and as right-wing leaders, we threw everything at the wall to see what would stick. And to our surprise, the thing that seemed to stick was transgender young people. And we found that we could use them as a very effective scapegoat, with the end goal still, of course, being mandated conformity from everyone, right? The end goal hasn't changed, but we needed a new vehicle to try to get there. And so, you know, again, the right wing has not been shy about what they are up to with this. They've not been shy about the fact that they don't particularly care about, you know, one particular community or one set of rights or freedoms. They're coming for all of it, but they just seem to, or they think they have found something very salient in the transgender community. And that is in large part because they know that the majority of people in this country don't know a trans person. And so in the absence of knowledge and awareness about the trans community, they think they can fill that vacuum with lies, with misinformation, with fear and scapegoating, and then use that as an on-ramp to propel the rest of their agenda.
And they're also using the existence of trans people as a wedge to drive between kind of the more moderate and the more progressive wings on our side, which is... has been horrifying. You know, we've seen, like, I think part of what they did when they were forming the strategy is looked at the data. They were throwing that spaghetti at the wall, like you said, but they were also looking at the data. And I think the data backed up, unfortunately, some of what they were talking about. And we've seen other polls recently, and some data scientists are talking about the slippage of support for marriage equality. And Ryan Burge, who's a professor who does a lot of really interesting work on the religious demographics in this country, including especially the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, he noted that in Christian nationalist quarters, there has been weakening of support for marriage equality. And some of the numbers were more alarming than I thought. So from 2018 to 2022, support was down 15 points among mainline Protestants aged 18 to 39, 14 points among Catholics of the same age, though there is still solid majorities supporting it. And then evangelicals of that same age dropped from 55 to 47, so no longer a majority. Do you have a sense of what is happening there, more less on the legal side, but more on the popularity public side of what's going on?
Yeah, well, I'll say a couple of things. One, I think it is important for us to name some of the softening of support that we're saying. And it's also important for us to acknowledge that there is still very broad support for marriage equality. And by the way, non-discrimination protections for LGBTQ plus people writ large in this country. I saw some recent polling, I think it was, you know, maybe earlier this year, that showed like nearly 70% of Americans support marriage equality. And I mean, in the age of Donald Trump and like everyone having a social media hot take,
point.
I actually don't know how many issues you could find with 70% support.
Point.
So, you know, and when you think about how quickly we've gotten there, right, it was, you know, 2004, 2005, that states were passing bans on same-sex marriage by constitutional amendment. Like, that is a huge leap in support to have happen in 20 years. So I want to couch in that I hope folks understand that, you know, marriage equality enjoys very, very broad support across the country. But your question is an important one, which is, you know, why are we seeing some softening? Why are we seeing softening in particular demographics? And I think it comes back to the right wing's aim, right? The reason that they've used transgender young people as a scapegoat, the reason that, you know, they've started to try to push the Overton window in some of these state legislatures, And that's because the goal has always been to soften support for LGBTQ plus people by using particular wedge issues and scapegoats, to peel away people's support for the community at large. The goal is always to curtail everyone's freedom, right? Again, it's to make sure that we're living as we're told. And when you look at some of what Project 2025 is signaling to the country about, you know, what's next or what is a priority, if you look at Project 2025, it is very explicit in saying that, you know, the right wing believes the federal government should be a propaganda apparatus for heterosexuality. They believe that the federal government should be promoting heterosexual relationships as the ideal kind of relationship. And so when you understand that that is their aim, to erode support for, you know, LGBTQ plus people more broadly, you also understand why they have so aggressively used trans people as a scapegoat to try to accomplish that. They, you know, they've painted trans people as this shadowy monster under the bed in an effort to scare people into agreeing that the entire community is bad. We all pose a threat to society and we should all be forced to conform, to get back in line. And I will also say that some of the reason you've seen those attacks ramp up is because the future that the right wing is so afraid of is already here. At the very same time that you see some of that, you know, perhaps softening in some demographics around support for marriage equality, you see a sharp increase in the number of young people who are mm-hmm. comfortable being openly LGBTQ, right? There was some polling that was done at the end of last year that showed 30%+ of Gen Z identify as LGBTQ plus. That means we've reached a place in society where more young people than ever feel comfortable being out and proud and exactly who they are. And it is that reality, it is that future that has the right wing so afraid that has caused them to escalate their attacks on trans people, cause them to, you know, accelerate their plans to test the waters around other issues, HIV and AIDS prevention and marriage equality in these state legislatures, again, because they are terrified of what the future might hold if more and more people feel comfortable being out and proud as LGBTQ+. So I would say that's, again, what makes it so important that we keep illuminating the threads that tie all of these things together. We keep refusing to let the right wing use trans people as a scapegoat and siphon them off into their own, you know, isolated category. It is why it's so important that we build solidarity with each other, because that is the antidote to what they're cooking up that's eroding support for the LGBTQ plus community.
I couldn't agree more with that. I do think building that community and solidarity right now are so, so very important. So I want to pivot back to the kind of the main question that I asked you to come on here to talk about. So right now there's no real vehicle at the Supreme Court. Your lawyers aren't too worried at HRC, but we understand why people are worried. Can you help folks understand what would happen if, right? Like what would the country look like if the worst should happen? And I really want, because you mentioned the federal legislation, I'm pretty sure you were talking about the Respect for Marriage Act that HRC did a lot to get through. Talk about what things would look like should this happen.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you starting sort of where we began, which is this question of, you know, is there an imminent threat to marriage today? The answer to that is no. And so I think first, you know, let's address what would have to happen for us to get there.
Yes, good idea.
Again, there's no open question here about marriage equality in this country. That is settled law, which means they would have to create that question legally, right? And of course, like, we know that that's not out of the question for them. Roe v. Wade was settled law, and, you know, ADF and others decided they were going to force their agenda on us. And so they called the question. So I do want to say it's not impossible. We certainly know that the ADF has its sights set on LGBTQ plus people. That's why they've been designated as a hate group. They are very targeted in their hate. So in order for us to get there, there would have to be a question called, right, on marriage equality. There would have to be a vehicle that would cause the Supreme Court to revisit the Obergefell ruling. At odds, there would be things like equal protection and due process. There are a couple of different avenues that marriages are protected, you know, under federal law. And then, you know, I will say that would give us a lot of room to respond. So it wouldn't sneak up on people. It would not happen tomorrow or next week. It would be very clear that that is what's happening. And there would be a lot of opportunities for the community to engage, to push back, to fight back. And then, you know, as you mentioned, let's say we get to the place where the question is called, the Supreme Court, you know, reverses its ruling in Obergefell. The landscape does not return to pre-Obergefell America, which was a hodgepodge of different rules. And it meant as you traveled across state lines, your rights varied based on what the state laws said. Because of the Respect for Marriage Act, every state is required to respect a legally recognized marriage. So, you know, let's say you got married in the state of Massachusetts and you drove to West Virginia, where they no longer allowed for same-sex marriages. The Respect for Marriage Act, being the law of the land, requires West Virginia to legally recognize your marriage in the same way that it would recognize any others, you know, even though you've crossed over state lines. So that is the benefit of having that extra layer of federal protection. Also, by the way, laws really matter. They're very hard to go back and undo. So even in the case that we got into a situation where the Supreme Court revisited the Obergefell ruling, you know, we would not go back to pre-Obergefell America with this hodgepodge of whether or not you can access your rights. The Respect for Marriage Act gives you that extra layer of protection to ensure that your legally recognized marriage is treated the same in every state.
And I think that's such an important point for people to understand that it, I do think a lot of the folks that I have talked to that have come to me with worries about this are worried about it going back to that pre-Obergefell landscape, and that is not what it will look like. The Respect for Marriage Act has changed that. So even if Obergefell goes away, things are going to be different than they were beforehand. That to me is just one of the crucial points in this discussion. And, you know,
it really is. Yeah. And I think I appreciate you underscoring that. And I do just want to like maybe make that really crystal clear for folks that
Please.
While the Respect for Marriage Act could not in law force states to, you know, like to do certain marriages or others, that's not the way the law works. What the Respect for Marriage Act does say is from a federal standpoint, you cannot treat, you know, one marriage one way in this state and another marriage, you know, that way in a different state. If somebody gets married and their marriage is legally recognized, every state is required to respect it. And again, that changes the dynamic. It does not mean that we would go back to a pre-Obergefell America. It means that, you know, again, if you got married in Massachusetts or New York or California and then got in your car and took a road trip, that your marriage would be valid and recognized in every state that you went through on that road trip.
Thanks for listening to the free version of today's episode. To get the whole conversation, unfiltered and unfettered, sign up at accessmundi.us. Costs less than that latte you bought on the way to work, and I am just as delicious. Signing up also gets you premium content from Straight White American Jesus and other Access Mundi shows. Try it. You can always change your mind because life is too good to waste on bad ideas. This has been One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew Seidel. Until next time.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.